The priests clambered down a rope ladder. Rollo last. Two sailors grasped the oars. The boat shushed through the waves. On the beach, Rollo could faintly discern the figure of a small woman with a dog. Marjorie. He breathed easier. The boat bumped the slope of the beach. The priests jumped out into the shallows. Marjorie greeted them with a handshake, saying nothing. Her well-trained dog was equally silent. Rollo remained in the boat. Marjorie looked at him, caught his eye, grinned, and touched her chin as if stroking a beard. She had not seen him like this before. Fool, he thought, and quickly turned away. The priests must not find out that Rollo was Marjorie's brother. They knew him only as Jean Langlais. The sailors pushed off the beach and began to row back to the Petite Fleur. Rollo looked astern from the boat and watched Marjorie lead the priests stumbling across the pebbles, then into the cottage. They crowded through the front door and were lost from sight. Malroper, his wife Peg, and their three strapping sons knelt on the stone floor of the single downstairs room of the cottage while Lenny Price said Mass. Marjorie almost wept to see the joy of these simple believers as they received the sacraments. If she lost her life for the sake of this moment, she thought, it would be worth it. She often thought of her great aunt, Sister Joan, now dead. The troubled young Marjorie, 16-year-old bride, had climbed to the top floor of her father's house, where old Joan had turned two little rooms into a monastic cell and a chapel. There, Joan had told her that God had a purpose for her, but she must just wait for him to reveal it. Well, Joan had been right. Marjorie had waited, and God had revealed his purpose, and this was it. The demand for Catholic priests was huge. Marjorie talked to aristocratic and wealthy Catholics in London whenever Bart attended Parliament. Discreetly, she sounded them out, and soon found that many were desperate for the sacraments. In London, Marjorie was careful to stay away from the French and Spanish embassies, to avoid the suspicion of conspiracy. She had persuaded Bart to be equally chary. He supported her mission. He hated Protestantism, but in middle age he had become lazy and passive, and he was happy to let her do all the work as long as she let him feel like a hero. Marjorie did not mind. After the service, Peg Roper served them all a hearty fish stew in wooden bowls with coarse home-baked bread. Marjorie was glad to see the priests tucking in. They had a long way to go before daybreak. The Ropers were not rich, but Mal refused money. "I thank you, my lady, but we don't need payment to do God's will," he said. Marjorie saw that he was proud to say this, and she accepted his refusal. It was midnight when they left. Marjorie had two lanterns. She led the way with one, and Lenny brought up the rear with the other. She headed due north, along a familiar road. She urged silence on the men every time they approached a village or farmhouse, for she did not want them to be heard or seen. A group of nine people walking at night would arouse suspicion and hostility in the mind of anyone who saw them. Marjorie was particularly cautious near larger manor houses, where there might be men-at-arms who could be sent out with torches to question the travellers. The night was mild, and the road was dry. All the same, Marjorie found the walking hard. Ever since the birth of her second child, Roger, she had suffered occasional backache, especially when she had to walk a long distance. She just had to grit her teeth and bear it. Every 2 or 3 hours she stopped at a pre-selected spot, far from human habitation, where they rested, drank water from a stream, ate some of the bread Peg Roper had given them for their journey, and relieved themselves before setting off again. Marjorie listened hard as she walked along, alert for the sounds of other people on the road. In a city, there would have been people skulking along the lanes, usually about some criminal business. But here in the countryside, there was little to steal, and therefore fewer criminals. All the same, she remained cautious. Marjorie had cried for a whole day when she heard about the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. All those people murdered by Catholics. It was much worse than a battle in which soldiers killed soldiers. In Paris, the citizens had slaughtered defenseless women and children in the thousands. How could God permit it? And then, to make it worse, the Pope had sent a letter of congratulation to the King of France. That could not be God's will. Hard though it was to believe, the Pope had done wrong. Marjorie had known that Ned was in Paris at the time, and she had feared for his life. but then it was announced that everyone in the English embassy had survived. Hard on the heels of that came the news that Ned had married a French girl. It made Marjorie sad. Quite unreasonably, she felt. She had had the chance to run away with him, and she had refused. He could not spend his life yearning for her. He wanted a wife and a family. She should have been glad that he had found happiness without her, but she could not bring herself to rejoice. She wondered what the new Mrs. Willard was like. People said that French women were terribly sophisticated. Would she be beautifully dressed and dripping with jewellery? Marjorie found herself hoping that the girl was an empty-headed flibbertigibbet who would quickly bore Ned. What an unworthy hope, she thought. I should wish him happiness. I do. A faint light was visible in the east as they approached Newcastle, and she was able to make out the battlements against the sky. A feeling of weary relief came over her. It had been a long walk. The road led directly to the entrance. As always, the rooks on the walls jeered at the visitors. Marjorie hammered on the gate. A face appeared briefly at an arrow-slit window in the gatehouse, and a minute later, a sleepy sentry hauled open the heavy wooden door. They went in, and the door was barred behind them. At last, Marjorie felt safe. She led her charges across the courtyard and ushered them into the chapel. "In a few minutes, the castle servants will bring you breakfast and bedding," she told them. "Then you can sleep. All day and all night, if you wish. But remember the need for secrecy. The people here are all Catholics, but even so you should not ask their names nor tell them yours. Don't ask questions about where you are or who owns the castle. What you don't know you can't reveal, even under torture." They had been told all this before by Rollo, but it could hardly be repeated too often. Tomorrow she would take them out in pairs and set them on the roads for their different destinations. Two were going west to Exeter, two north to Wells, two northeast to Salisbury, and two east to Arundel. When she said goodbye, they would be on their own. She left the church and crossed the courtyard to the house. The arrival of the priests had already caused a flurry of activity, and the servants were up and busy. She went upstairs to the boys' room. They were asleep in side-by-side beds. She leaned over Bartlett, now 7, big for his age, and kissed his head. Then she moved to little Roger, not yet 2, with fair hair. She kissed his soft cheek. Roger opened his eyes. They were golden brown, the same as Ned's. Sylvie had been looking forward to her first visit to Kingsbridge. This was the town that had made the man she loved. They had been married less than a year, and she felt there was still much to be learned about Ned. She knew that he was brave and kind and clever. She knew every inch of his body and cherished it all, and when they made love, she felt as if she were in his head and knew everything he was thinking. But there were gaps in her knowledge, topics he did not say much about, times in his life he rarely referred to. He talked a lot about Kingsbridge, and she was eager to see it. Most of all, she wanted to meet the people who had been important to him, people he loved and hated. Especially the woman in the little painting that had stood beside his shaving mirror in his room in Paris. They were prompted to visit by a letter from Ned's brother, Barney. He had come home to Kingsbridge, he said, with his son.
"I didn't know he had a son,"
Ned said, reading the letter in the parlour of the small house they had rented near St. Paul's Cathedral. Sylvie said, "Does he have a wife?" "I presume so. You can't have children otherwise. But it's odd that he doesn't mention her.
Can you get Walsingham's permission to leave London?"
Sylvie knew that Ned and Walsingham were busy enlarging Queen Elizabeth's secret intelligence service, making lists of men who might conspire to overthrow the Queen and replace her with Mary Stuart.
"Yes,"
Ned said. "He'll want me to make a few discreet inquiries about Catholics in the county of Shiring, especially Earl Bart, but I can manage that easily." They went from London to Kingsbridge on horseback, taking a relaxed 5 days for the journey. Sylvie was not yet pregnant, so there was no danger to her from horseback riding. She was disappointed that it was taking her so long to conceive, but happily, Ned had not complained. Sylvie was used to capital cities. She had always lived in Paris until she married Ned, and since coming to England, they had lived in London. Provincial towns felt safer, more tranquil, less frenetic. She liked Kingsbridge immediately. She was struck by the stone angel on top of the cathedral's spire. Ned told her that, according to legend, the angel had the face of Caris, the nun who had founded the hospital. Sylvie wondered disapprovingly why the statue had not been beheaded, like all the other idolatrous images of saints and angels. "They can't reach it," Ned explained. "They'd need to build scaffolding." He spoke lightly. He was somewhat lax about such matters. He added, "But you should go up the tower one day. The view over the town is magnificent." Kingsbridge reminded her of Rouen, with its riverside docks and the great cathedral at its heart. It had the same air of lively prosperity. Thinking of Rouen turned her mind to her plan to continue smuggling Protestant literature into Paris. She had received one letter from Nath, forwarded by the English embassy. It had been an enthusiastic missive. Nath was thriving as a clandestine bookseller, but for now she had plenty of stock, and she would write to Sylvie as soon as she began to run low. Meanwhile, Sylvie had come up with another plan to run parallel with the first. There were thousands of Huguenot refugees in London, many of them struggling to learn English, and she thought she could sell them books in French. A foreigner would not be allowed to open a bookshop within the city of London, Ned told her, so she was looking for premises outside the walls, perhaps in the suburb of Southwark, where many of the refugees lived. Sylvie liked Barney immediately. Most women did, Ned told her with a smile. Barney wore a sailor's baggy breeches with tightly laced shoes and a fur hat. His red beard was luxuriant, covering most of his weather-beaten face. He had a rapscallion grin that Sylvie guessed would make many girls go weak at the knees. When they arrived at the house opposite the cathedral, he embraced Ned warmly and kissed Sylvie a little more enthusiastically than was quite appropriate. Both Ned and Sylvie were expecting his son to be a baby, but Alpha was 9 years old. He was dressed in a miniature version of Barney's seafaring outfit, including the fur hat. The child had light brown skin, curly red hair like Barney's, and the same green eyes. He was obviously African, and even more obviously, Barney's son. Sylvie crouched down to talk to him.
"What's your name?" she said. "I am Barnardo Alfonso Willard."
Barney said, "We call him Alfo." Sylvie said,
"Hello, Alfo. I am your aunt, Sylvie." "I am pleased to meet you," the boy said formally. Someone had taught him good manners.
Ned said to Barney, "And his mother?" Tears came to Barney's eyes.
"The loveliest woman I ever knew."
"Where is she?"
"In a graveyard in Hispaniola, New Spain."
"I'm so sorry, brother."
Alfo said, "Eileen looks after me."
The house was cared for by the Fifes, an elderly couple with a daughter, Eileen, in her 20s. Ned smiled. "And soon you'll go to Kingsbridge Grammar School, like your father and me, and you'll learn to write Latin and count money."
"I don't want to go to school," Alfo said. "I want to be a sailor like the captain."
"We'll see," said Barney. To Ned, he explained. "He knows I'm his father, but on board ship he got into the habit of calling me captain, as the men do." On the day after they arrived, Ned took Sylvie to meet the Fonons, Kingsbridge's leading Huguenot family, and they all chattered in French. Sylvie's English was coming along fast, but it was a relief to be able to relax and talk without having to search for words. The Fonons had a precocious 10-year-old daughter, Valerie, who took it upon herself to teach Sylvie some useful English phrases, which amused everyone. The Fonons wanted to know all about the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which was still being discussed with horror all over Europe. Everyone Sylvie met asked about it. On the third day, Sylvie received a costly gift, a bolt of fine Antwerp cloth, enough to make a dress, from Dan Cobley, the richest man in town. Sylvie had heard his name before. She and Ned had sailed from Paris to London on one of Dan's ships.
"He wants to ingratiate himself with me," Ned said, "just in case one day he needs a royal favor."
Dan called the next day, and Sylvie took him into the front parlor, the room with the view of the cathedral, and gave him wine and cakes. He was a pompous, fat man, and Ned spoke to him in uncharacteristically curt tones. When Dan had gone, Sylvie asked Ned why he disliked Dan so much. "He's a hypocritical Puritan," Ned said. "He dresses in black and complains about kissing in plays. Then he cheats people in business." A more important blank in the story of Ned's life
was filled in when they were invited to dinner at the home of Lady Susanna Twyford, a voluptuous woman in her 50s. It took Sylvie about a minute to figure out that Susanna had been Ned's lover. She talked to him with an easy intimacy that could only come from a sexual relationship. Ned looked happy and relaxed with her. Sylvie felt bothered. She knew Ned had not been a virgin when they married, but actually seeing him smiling fondly at an old flame was a bit hard to take. Susanna must have picked up Sylvie's anxiety, for she sat down next to her and held both her hands. "Ned is so happy to be married to you, Sylvie, and I can see why," she said. "I always hoped he would meet someone courageous and bright, as well as beautiful. He's a special man, and he deserves a special woman."
"He seems very fond of you."
"Yes," Susanna admitted, "and I'm fond of him, but he's in love with you, and that's so different. I do hope you and I can be friends."
"I hope so too," said Sylvie.
"I met Ned when he was 32, so I'd be foolish to imagine I was the first woman he fell for. Funny, though, how we do sometimes imagine silly things when we're in love."
Sylvie realized this woman was wise and kind, and she felt easier in her mind. Sylvie entered the cathedral for the first time on Whitsunday, for the festival of Pentecost.
"This is wonderful,"
Sylvie said, as they walked along the nave.
"It's a magnificent church," Ned agreed. "I never tire of studying it." "It is. But that's not what I mean. There are no marble statues, no garish paintings, no jeweled boxes of ancient bones."
"Your Huguenot churches and meeting halls are like that." Sylvie switched to French in order to express herself better.
"But this is a cathedral. It's huge and beautiful, and hundreds of years old. The way churches are supposed to be. And it's Protestant, too. In France, a Huguenot service is a hole-in-the-corner affair in some kind of improvised space, never seeming to be quite the right thing. To have a Protestant service in a place where people have worshipped God for centuries makes me rejoice."
"I'm so glad," said Ned. "You've been through more misery than any five other people. You're entitled to some happiness." They approached a tall man of about Sylvie's age, with a handsome face reddened by drink, his stout figure clad in a costly yellow coat.
"Sylvie, this is Bart, the Earl of Shiring. An earl is the same as a count."
Sylvie remembered that Ned had to check on the local Catholics, of whom Bart was the most prominent. She curtsied. Bart smiled, inclined his head in a slight bow, and gave her a roguish look.
"You're a sly one, Ned, to come home with a pretty French wench," he said.
Sylvie had an idea that the word wench was not quite polite, but she decided to ignore it. The Earl had an expensively dressed little boy at his side, and she said,
"And who is this young man?"
"My son, Bartlett, the Viscount,"
Bart said.
"He's just had his 9th birthday. Shake hands, Bartlett, and say how do you do."
The boy complied. He had the same vigorous physical presence as his father, despite being small. Sylvie smiled to see a wooden sword at his belt. Ned said, "And this is Countess Marjorie." Sylvie looked up and saw, with a shock, the woman in the little painting. It was a second jolt to realize that in real life she was much more striking. Although older than the painting, she had a few faint lines around her eyes and mouth, and Sylvie put her age at 30, the living woman had an air of vivacity and charisma that was like the charged atmosphere of stormy weather. She had luxuriant curly hair, imperfectly tamed, and wore a little red hat at an angle.
"No wonder he loved you," Sylvie thought immediately.
Marjorie acknowledged Sylvie's curtsy, studying her with frank interest. Then she looked at Ned, and Sylvie saw love in her eyes. Marjorie radiated happiness as she said hello to Ned.
"You haven't got over him," Sylvie thought. "You'll never get over him. He's the love of your life."
Sylvie looked at Ned. He too looked happy. He had a big place in his heart for Marjorie. There was no doubt about that. Sylvie felt dismayed. Susanna Twyford had been a bit startling, but had been no more than fond of Ned. Marjorie had far stronger feelings, and Sylvie was unnerved.
"She wants my husband," Sylvie thought. "Well, she can't have him."
Then Sylvie noticed a child of about 2 years, still unsteady on his legs, standing half-concealed by the full skirt of Marjorie's red dress. Marjorie followed Sylvie's look and said,
"And this is my second son, Roger."
She bent down and picked up the toddler with a swift motion.
"Roger, this is Sir Ned Willard," she said. "He's a very important person who works for the Queen."
Roger pointed at Sylvie.
"Is she the Queen?"
he said. They all laughed. Ned said, "She's my Queen."
"Thank you, Ned,"
Sylvie thought. Ned said to Marjorie, "Is your brother here?"
"We don't see much of Rollo nowadays,"
Marjorie said. "Where is he, then?"
"He has become a counsellor to the Earl of Tyne."
"I'm sure his legal training and business experience make him useful to the Earl. Does he live at Tyne Castle?"
"He's based there, but the Earl has properties all over the north of England, and I gather Rollo travels a lot on his behalf."
Ned was still checking on the local Catholics, but Sylvie was looking at the little boy, Roger. There was something about him that bothered her, and after a minute, she realized that the boy had a familiar look. He resembled Ned. Sylvie looked at Ned and saw him studying Roger with a faint frown. He, too, had noticed something. Sylvie could read his face effortlessly, and she could tell, from his expression, that he had not yet figured out what was puzzling him. Men were not as quick as women to spot resemblances. Sylvie caught Marjorie's eye, and the two women understood one another instantly. But Ned was merely puzzled, and Earl Bart was oblivious. The service began with a hymn, and there was no further conversation until the ceremony came to an end. Then they had guests for dinner, and with one thing and another, Sylvie did not get Ned on his own until bedtime. It was spring, and they both got into bed naked. Sylvie touched the hair on Ned's chest.
"Marjorie loves you," she said.
"She's married to the Earl."
"That won't stop her."
"How can you say that?"
"Because she's lain with you already."
Ned looked cross and said nothing.
"It must have been about 3 years ago, just before you came to Paris."
"How do you know?"
"Because Roger is too."
"Oh, you noticed.
He has your eyes."
She looked into Ned's eyes.
"That's wonderful, golden brown."
"You're not angry?"
"I knew when I married you that I was not the first woman you'd loved, but..."
"Go on."
"But I didn't know you might still love her, or that she had had your child."
Ned took both her hands in his. "I can't tell you that I'm indifferent to her. I don't care about her," he said. "But please understand that you are all I want." It was the right thing to say, but Sylvie was not sure she believed him. All she knew was that she loved him and she was not going to let anyone take him away.
"Make love to me," she said.
He kissed her. "My goodness, you're a hard taskmaster," he joked. Then he kissed her again. But this was not enough. She wanted something with him that Susanna Twyford and Marjorie Shiring had never shared.
"Wait," she said, thinking, "is there something you've always thought about doing with that woman?"
She had never before talked like this to him, or to anyone.
"Something that excites you when you imagine it, but you've never done it."
She held her breath. What would he say? He looked thoughtful and a little embarrassed.
"There is,"
she said triumphantly.
"I can tell."
She was glad she could read his face so easily.
"What is it?"
"I'm embarrassed to say." Now he looked bashful. It was sweet. She wriggled closer to him, pressing her body against his. In a low voice, she said,
"Then whisper."
He whispered in her ear. She looked at him, grinning, a little surprised but also aroused.
"Really?"
He shook his head. "No, forget it. I shouldn't have said it." She felt excited, and she could tell he was too.
"I don't know," she said, "but we could try it."
So they did. Part 4, 1583 to 1589. Chapter 22. Ned studied the face of his son, Roger. His heart was so full he could hardly speak. Roger was a child on the edge of adolescence, starting to grow taller, but still having smooth cheeks and a treble voice. He had Marjorie's curly, dark hair and impish look. but Ned's golden brown eyes. They were in the parlour of the house opposite the cathedral. Earl Bart had come to Kingsbridge for the spring court of quarter sessions, and had brought with him the two boys he thought were his sons, Bartlett, who was 18, and Roger, 12. Ned, too, had come for the court. He was the Member of Parliament for Kingsbridge now. Ned had no other children. He and Sylvie had been making love for more than 10 years, with a fervour that had hardly diminished, but she had never become pregnant. It was a cause of sadness to them both, and it made Roger painfully precious to Ned. Ned was also recalling his own adolescence. "I know what you have in front of you," he thought, as he looked at Roger, "and I wish I could tell you all about it, and make it easier for you. But when I was your age, I never believed older people who said they knew what the lives of younger ones were like, and I don't suppose you will either." Roger's attitude to Ned was, naturally, quite casual. Ned was a friend of his mother's, and Roger regarded him as an unofficial uncle. Ned could not display his affection except by listening carefully to the boy, taking him seriously, and replying thoughtfully to what he said. And perhaps that was why Roger occasionally confided in him, something that gave Ned great joy. Now Roger said,
"Sir Ned, you know the Queen. Why does she hate Catholics?"
Ned had not expected that, though perhaps he should have. Roger knew that his parents were Catholics in a Protestant country, and he had just become old enough to wonder why. Ned played for time by saying, "The Queen doesn't hate Catholics.
She makes my father pay a fine for not going to church."
Roger was quick-thinking, Ned saw, and the little flush of pleasure he felt was accompanied by a painful stab of regret that he had to conceal his pride, most especially from the boy himself. Ned said to Roger what he said to everyone. "When she was young, Princess Elizabeth told me that if she became queen, no Englishman would die for his religion."
"She hasn't kept that promise,"
Roger said quickly. "She has tried." Ned searched for words that would explain the complexities of politics to a 12-year-old. "On the one hand, she has Puritans in Parliament telling her every day that she's too soft and she should be burning Catholics to death, just as her predecessor, Queen Mary Tudor, burned Protestants. On the other hand, she has to deal with Catholic traitors, such as the Duke of Norfolk, who want to kill her." Roger argued stubbornly,
"Priests are executed just for bringing people back to the Catholic faith, aren't they?"
Roger had been saving up these questions, Ned realized. He was probably afraid to challenge his parents about such matters. Ned was pleased the boy trusted him enough to share his worries. But why was Roger so concerned? Ned guessed that Stephen Lincoln was still living more or less clandestinely at Newcastle. He would be tutor to Bartlett and Roger, and almost certainly said mass regularly for the family. Roger was worried that his teacher might be found out and executed. There were many more such priests than there had been. Stephen was one of the old diehards, left over after Queen Elizabeth's religious revolution, but there were dozens of new priests, perhaps hundreds. Ned and Walsingham had caught 17 of them. All had been executed for treason. Ned had questioned most of the 17 before they died. He had not learned as much as he wished, partly because they had been trained to resist interrogation, but mainly because they did not know much. Their organizer worked under the obvious pseudonym of Jean Langlais, and gave them only the absolute minimum of information about the operation of which they were part. They did not know exactly where on the coast they had landed, nor the names of the shadowy people who welcomed them and sent them on the road to their destinations. Ned said, "These priests are trained abroad and smuggled into England illegally. They owe allegiance to the Pope, not to our Queen. Some of them belong to a hardline ultra-Catholic group called the Jesuits. Elizabeth fears they may conspire to overthrow her."
"And do they conspire?"
Roger asked. If Ned had been arguing with an adult, he would have responded disputatiously to these questions. He might have scorned the naivety of anyone who supposed that clandestine priests were innocent of treachery. But he had no wish to win an argument with his son. He just wanted the boy to know the truth. The priests all believed that Elizabeth was illegitimate, and that the true Queen of England was Mary Stuart, the Queen of the Scots. But none of them had actually done anything about it, so far. At least. They had not tried to contact Mary Stuart in her prison, They had not called together groups of discontented Catholic noblemen. They had not plotted to murder Elizabeth.
No,
he said to Roger. As far as I know, they don't conspire against Elizabeth.
So they are executed just for being Catholic priests?
You are right, morally speaking, Ned said, and it is a great sadness to me that Elizabeth has not been able to keep her youthful vow. But politically, it is quite impossible for her to tolerate, within her kingdom, a network of men who are loyal to a foreign potentate, the Pope, who has declared himself her enemy. No monarch on earth would put up with that.
And if you hide a priest in your house, the penalty is death.
So that was the thought at the heart of Roger's worry. If Stephen Lincoln were caught saying Mass, or even proved to keep sacramental objects at Newcastle, then both Bart and Marjorie could be executed. Ned, too, was fearful for Marjorie. He might not be able to protect her from the wrath of the law. He said, I believe we should all worship God in the way we think right, and not worry about what other people do. I don't hate Catholics. I've been friends with your mother and father all my life. I don't think Christians should kill each other over theology.
It's not just Catholics who burn people. The Protestants in Geneva burned Michel Servet.
Ned thought of saying that the name of Servet was known all over Europe precisely because it was so unusual for Protestants to burn people to death. But he decided not to take that argumentative line with Roger. Instead, he said, that's true, and it will be a stain on the name of John Calvin until the Day of Judgment. But there are a few people on both sides who struggle for tolerance. Queen Katerina, the mother of the King of France, is one, and she's Catholic. Queen Elizabeth is another. But they both kill people. Neither woman is a saint. There's something you must try to understand, Roger. There are no saints in politics, but imperfect people can still change the world for the better. Ned had done his best, but Roger looked dissatisfied. He did not want to be told that life was complicated. He was 12 years old, and he sought ringing certainties. He would have to learn slowly, like everyone else. The conversation was interrupted when Alpha walked in. Roger immediately clammed up, and a few moments later, politely took his leave. Alpha said to Ned,
What did he want?
He's having adolescent dance. He treats me as a harmless friend of the family. How is school? Alpha sat down. He was 19 now, and he had Barney's long limbs and easygoing ways. The truth is, a year ago the school had already taught me all it could. Now I spend half my time reading and the other half teaching the youngsters. Oh? It was clearly Ned's day for counselling young men. He was only 43, not old enough for such responsibility. Perhaps you should go to Oxford and study at the university. You could live at Kingsbridge College. Ned was only mildly keen on this idea. He himself had never studied at a university, and he could not say that he had suffered much in consequence. He was as smart as most of the clergymen he met. On the other hand, he occasionally noticed that university-educated men were more agile than he in arguments, and he knew they had learned that in student debates.
I'm not cut out to be a clergyman.
Ned smiled. Alpha was fond of girls, and they liked him, too. He had inherited Barney's effortless charm. Timid girls were put off by his African looks, but the more adventurous were intrigued. English people were illogical about foreigners, Ned found. They hated Turks, and they believed Jews were evil, but they regarded Africans as harmlessly exotic. Men such as Alpha, who somehow ended up in England, usually married into the community, where their inherited appearance disappeared in the course of 3 or 4 generations. Going to university doesn't mean you're obliged to become a clergyman, but I sense that you have something else in mind.
My grandmother Alice had a dream of turning the old monastery into an indoor market.
That's true, she did. It was a long time ago. But Ned had not forgotten looking around the ruins with his mother, imagining the stalls set up in the cloisters. It's still a good idea.
Could I use the captain's money to buy the place?
Ned considered. He had charge of Barney's wealth while Barney was at sea. He kept a lot of it in cash, but he had made some investments too, an orchard in Kingsbridge, a dairy in London, and had made money for his brother.
I think we might, if the price is right.
He said cautiously.
May I approach the chapter?
Do some research first. Ask about recent sales of building land in Kingsbridge. How much per acre?
I'll do that,
Alfo said eagerly. Be discreet. Don't tell people what you're planning. Say I've asked you to look for a building plot for myself. Then we'll talk about how much to offer for the monastery.
Eileen Fife came into the room with a packet in her hand. She smiled affectionately at Alfo and handed the packet to Ned.
A messenger brought this from London for you, Sir Ned. He's in the kitchen, if you want him.
Give him something to eat, Ned said.
I've done so already,
Eileen said, indignant that Ned should think she might have omitted this courtesy.
Of course you have. Forgive me.
Ned opened the packet. There was a letter for Sylvie addressed in Knapp's childlike handwriting, undoubtedly forwarded by the English Embassy in Paris. It would probably be a request for more books, something that had happened 3 times in the last 10 years. Ned knew, from Knapp's letters and from Sylvie's visits to Paris, that Knapp had taken over Sylvie's role in more than bookselling. She still worked as maid to the family of Pierre Aumont de Guise, and she continued to watch Pierre and pass information to the Paris Protestants. Pierre had moved into the Guise palace, along with Odette, her son, Alain, now 22 and a student, and Knapp. This gave Knapp extra opportunities for espionage, especially on English Catholics in Paris. Knapp had also converted Alain to Protestantism, unknown to Odette or Pierre. All Knapp's information came to Sylvie in letters such as this one. Ned set it aside for Sylvie to open. The other letter was for him. It was written in clear, forward, slanted script, the work of a methodical man in a hurry, and Ned recognized it as that of Sir Francis Walsingham, his master. However, he could not read it immediately, because it was in code. He said to Eileen, "I need time to compose a reply. Give the messenger a bed for the night."
Alfo stood up. "I'll make a start on our new project. Thank you, Uncle Ned."
Ned began to decode his letter. There were only 3 sentences. It was tempting to write the decrypt above the coded message, but that practice was strictly forbidden. If a coded letter, with its decrypt, found its way into the wrong hands, the enemy would have a key to all other messages written in the same code. Ned's codebreakers, working on intercepted correspondence of foreign embassies in London, had benefited more than once from such carelessness on the part of the people on whom they spied. Ned wrote his decrypt with an iron pencil on a slate that could be wiped clean with a damp cloth. He had the code in his head, and he was able to decipher the opening sentence rapidly. "News from Paris." His pulse quickened. He and Walsingham were eager to find out what the French would do next. All through the 60s and 70s, Queen Elizabeth had held her enemies at bay by pretending to consider marriage proposals from Catholic princes. Her latest victim had been Hercule Francis, the brother of King Henri III of France. Elizabeth would be 50 this year, but she still had the power to fascinate men, and she had enraptured Hercule Francis, even though he was still in his 20s, calling him "my little frog." She had toyed with him for 3 years, until he came to the conclusion, reached eventually by all her suitors, that she had no intention of marrying anyone. But Ned felt she had played the marriage card for the last time, and he feared that her enemies might now do what they had been talking about for so long, and make a serious attempt to get rid of her. Ned was beginning on the second sentence, when the door was flung open and Marjorie burst in.
"How dare you?" she said. "How dare you?"
Ned was thunderstruck. Marjorie's sudden rages were much feared by her servants, but he had never been subjected to one. His relationship with her was friendly to the point of affection.
"What on earth have I done?" he said. "How dare you feed Protestant heresy to my son?"
Ned frowned. "Roger asked me questions," he said, reining in his indignation. "I tried to answer him honestly.
I will bring up my sons in the faith of their forefathers, and I won't have them corrupted by you."
"Fine," said Ned, with some exasperation. "But sooner or later someone's going to tell them that there's an alternative point of view. Be grateful it was me and not some bigoted Puritan such as Dan Cobley." Even while he was annoyed with her, he could not help noticing how attractive she was, tossing her abundant hair and flashing anger from her eyes. She was more beautiful at 40 than she had been at 14, when he had kissed her behind the tomb of Prior Philip. She said, "They would recognize Cobley for the bull-headed blasphemer that he is. you pose as a reasonable man while you poison their minds.
Ah, I understand. It's not my Protestantism you object to, it's my reasonableness. You don't want your sons to know that men can discuss religion quietly and disagree without trying to murder one another. Even while he argued with her, he realized vaguely that she did not really think he was poisoning Roger's mind. In truth, she was raging against the fate that had driven her and Ned apart so that they could not raise their child together. But she was like a charging horse and could not be stopped.
"Oh, you're so clever, aren't you?"
she raved. "No, but I don't pretend to be stupid, which is what you're doing now.
I didn't come here to argue. I'm telling you not to speak to my children."
Ned lowered his voice. "Roger is mine, too. He must not be made to suffer for my sins. Then don't force your religion down his throat. Tell him what you believe and admit that good men disagree. He will respect you more."
"Don't you dare tell me how to raise my children."
"Then don't you tell me what I may and may not say to my son." She went to the door.
"I'd tell you to go to hell, but you're on your way there already."
She left the room, and a moment later the front door slammed. Ned looked out of the window, but for once he did not enjoy the beauty of the cathedral. He was sorry to have quarrelled with Marjorie. One thing they were agreed upon. They would never tell Roger the truth about his parenthood. They both felt it would be deeply disturbing to the boy, or even to the man, later on, to learn that he had been so deceived all his life. Ned would never have the joy of acknowledging his only son, but he had to make that sacrifice for the boy's own sake. Roger's welfare was more important than Ned's. That was what it meant to be a parent. He looked down at his letter and transcribed the second sentence. "Cardinal Romero is back, and his mistress with him." That was significant. Romero was an informal envoy of the King of Spain. He must be plotting something with the French ultra-Catholics, and his mistress, Jerónima Ruiz, had spied for Ned at the time of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. Perhaps she would be willing to reveal what Romero was up to. As he was working on the third sentence, Sylvie came into the parlour. Ned handed her the letter that had come with his own. She did not open it immediately.
"I heard some of your conversation with Marjorie," she said. "The louder, but it sounded unpleasant."
Ned took her hand, feeling awkward. "I wasn't attempting to convert Roger. I just wanted to answer his questions honestly."
"I know.
I'm sorry if you were embarrassed by my old flame."
"I'm not embarrassed," Sylvie said. "I realized a long time ago that you love us both."
That startled Ned. It was true, but he had never admitted it. Reading his mind, Sylvie said,
"You can't hide that kind of thing from a wife."
She opened her letter. Ned looked again at his own. With half his mind on Sylvie's words, he decoded the last sentence. "Jerónima will talk only to you." He looked up at Sylvie, and the right words came to him. "As long as you know that I love you."
"Yes, I do. This is from Nat. She needs more books. I have to go to Paris."
"So do I," said Ned. Sylvie still had not climbed the cathedral tower to look at the view. After the Sunday service, with a spring sun shining through the coloured windows, she looked for the staircase up. There was a small door in the wall of the south transept that opened onto a spiral staircase. She was wondering whether she should ask permission, or just slip through the door, when Marjorie approached her.
"I had no right to come storming into your house and make such a scene,"
Marjorie said.
"I feel ashamed."
Sylvie closed the little door. This was important, and the view from the tower would always be there. She felt that she was the lucky one, and therefore she should be magnanimous to Marjorie.
"I understand why you were so upset," she said. "At least I think I do. And I really don't blame you."
"What do you mean?"
"You and Ned should be raising Roger together, but you can't, and it breaks your heart."
Marjorie looked shocked.
"Ned swore he would never tell anyone." "He didn't. I guessed, and he couldn't deny it. But the secret is safe with me. Bart will kill me if he finds out." "He won't find out. Thank you."
There were tears in Marjorie's eyes.
"If Ned had married you, he would have had a house full of children. But it seems I can't conceive.
It's not as if we don't try.
Sylvie was not sure why she was having such a candid conversation with the woman who loved her husband. It just seemed pointless to pretend.
I'm sorry to hear that, though I had guessed it. If I die before Ned, and Bart dies before you, then you should marry Ned. How can you say such a thing?
I'll look down from heaven and bless your marriage.
It's not going to happen, but thank you for saying it. You're a good woman. You are too.
Sylvie smiled.
Isn't he lucky?
Ned, do have the love of both of us.
I don't know, said Marjorie. Is he?
Rollo was awestruck by the Guise Palace. It was bigger than the Louvre. With its courtyards and gardens, it covered at least 2 acres. The place was thronged with servants and men-at-arms and distant relations and hangers-on, all of whom were fed daily and lodged every night. The stable block alone was bigger than the entire house Rollo's father had built in Kingsbridge at the height of his prosperity. Rollo was invited there in June of 1583 for a meeting with the Duke of Guise. Duke Scarface François was long dead, as was his brother, Cardinal Charles. François's son, Henri, aged 32, was now the Duke. Rollo studied him with fascination. By a coincidence that was regarded by most Frenchmen as divinely ordained, Henri had been wounded in the face, just like his father. François had been disfigured by a spear, whereas Henri had taken a bullet from an arquebus, but both had ended up with conspicuous marks, and now Henri, too, was nicknamed Scarface. The famously cunning Cardinal Charles had been replaced, in the councils of the Guise family, by Pierre Aumont de Guise, the low-born distant relative who had been Charles's protégé. Pierre was patron of the English college, and had given Rollo his alias of Jean Langlais, the name by which he was always known when engaged in secret work. Rollo met the Duke in a small but opulent room that was hung with paintings of biblical scenes, in which many of the women and men were naked. There was a distinct air of decadence that made Rollo uncomfortable. Rollo was flattered, but somewhat intimidated, by the high status of the other attendees. Cardinal Romero was here to represent the King of Spain, and Giovanni Castelli, the Pope. Claude Mathieu was the rector of the professed Jesuits. These men were the heavy artillery of Christian orthodoxy, and he felt amazed to find himself in their company. Pierre sat next to Duke Henri. Pierre's skin condition had worsened over the years, and now there were red flaking patches on his hands and neck, as well as at the corners of his eyes and mouth, and he scratched himself continually. 3 Guise attendants served wine and sweetmeats as the notables took their seats, then stood by the door awaiting further orders. Rollo assumed they were thoroughly trustworthy, but all the same, he would have made them wait outside. Secrecy had become an obsession with him. The only person in this room who knew his real name was Pierre. In England, it was the opposite. No one knew that Rollo Fitzgerald was Jean Langlais, not even his sister, Marjorie. Rollo was theoretically employed by the Earl of Tyne, who was a timid Catholic, devout, but frightened of conspiracy. The Earl paid him a salary, gave him indefinite leave of absence, and asked no questions. Duke Henri opened the discussion with a statement that thrilled Rollo. "We are here to talk about the invasion of England." This was Rollo's dream. The work he had been doing for the last 10 years, smuggling priests into England, was important, but palliative. It kept the true faith alive, but did nothing to change the status quo. Its true value was as preparation for this. An invasion led by Duke Henri could return England to the Catholic Church and restore the Fitzgerald family to its rightful position in the ruling elite. He saw it in his mind, the invasion fleet with banners flying, the armoured men pouring onto the beaches, the triumphal entry into London, cheered by the crowds, the coronation of Mary Stuart, and himself in bishop's robes, celebrating Mass in Kingsbridge Cathedral. Rollo understood, from his discussions with Pierre, that Queen Elizabeth was a major nuisance to the Guises. Whenever the ultra-Catholics got the upper hand in France, swarms of Huguenots sought asylum in England, where they were welcomed for their craft, skills, and enterprise. Prospering there, they sent money home to their co-religionists. Elizabeth also interfered in the Spanish Netherlands, permitting English volunteers to go there and fight on the rebel side. But Henri had another motive. "It is insupportable," he said, "that Elizabeth, who has been declared illegitimate by the Pope, should rule England and keep the true queen, Mary Stuart, in prison." Mary Stuart, the Queen of the Scots, was Duke Henri's cousin. If she became Queen of England, the Guises would be the supremely powerful family of Europe. No doubt, this was what was driving Henri and Pierre. Rollo suffered a moment of doubt about the domination of his country by a foreign family, but that was a small price to pay for a return to the true faith. "I see the inversion as a two-pronged fork," Henri said. "A force of 12,000 men will land at an east coast port, rally the local Catholic noblemen, and take control of the north of the country. Another force, perhaps smaller, will land on the south coast and again muster the Catholics to take control. Both groups, supplied and reinforced by English supporters, will march on London." The Jesuit leader said, "Very good. Padoue is going to pay for this." Cardinal Romero answered him, "The King of Spain has promised half the cost. King Felipe is fed up with English pirates attacking his transatlantic galleons and stealing their cargoes of gold and silver from New Spain."
"And the other half?"
Castelli said, "I believe the Pope will contribute, especially if shown a credible war plan." Rollo knew that kings and popes gave promises more readily than they gave cash. However, right now, money did not matter quite as much as usual. Duke Henri had just inherited 500,000 livres from his grandmother, so he was able to meet some of the expense himself, if necessary. Henri now said, "The invasion force will need plans of suitable harbours for the landing." Rollo realized that Pierre had choreographed this event. He already knew the answer to every question. The point of the meeting was to let each attendee know that all the others were willing to play their parts. Now Rollo said, "I will get the maps." Henri looked at Rollo.
"On your own?"
"No, Duke, not alone. I have a large network of powerful and wealthy Catholics in England." It was Marjorie's network, not Rollo's, but no one here realized that. And Rollo had always insisted on knowing where his priests were being sent, on the pretext of making sure they would be compatible with their protectors. Henri said,
"Can you rely on these people?"
"Your Grace, they are not just Catholics. They are men who are already risking the death penalty for harbouring the priests I have been smuggling into England for the last 10 years. They are utterly trustworthy." The Duke looked impressed.
"I see.
Not only will they supply maps, they will be the core of the uprising that will support the invasion."
"Very good," said Henri.
Pierre spoke for the first time.
"There remains one essential element. Mary Stuart, the Queen of the Scots. We cannot embark on this enterprise unless we have a clear commitment from her that she will support the rebellion, authorize the execution of Elizabeth, and assume the crown herself."
Rollo took a deep breath. "I will undertake to make sure of her," he said. He silently prayed that he would be able to keep this ambitious promise. Henri said,
"But she is in prison, and her letters are monitored."
"That's a problem, but not insuperable." The Duke seemed satisfied with that. He looked around the room. With the brisk impatience common to powerful men, he said,
"I think that's all. Gentlemen, thank you for your attendance."
Rollo glanced to the door and saw, to his surprise, that the three servants had been joined by a fourth person, a man in his early 20s, whose hair was cut in the short style fashionable among students. He looked vaguely familiar. Whoever he was, he had presumably heard Rollo promise to betray his country. Unnerved, Rollo pointed and said loudly,
"Who is that man?"
Pierre answered, "It's my stepson."
"What the devil are you doing here, Ella?"
Rollo recognized him now. He had seen the boy several times over the years. He had the blonde hair and beard of the Guise family.
"My mother is ill," Alain said.
Rollo watched with interest the procession of emotions over Pierre's face. At first, fleetingly, there was a look of hope, quickly repressed, then a mask of concern that did not quite convince Rollo, and finally, an expression of brisk efficiency, as he said, "Summon a doctor immediately. Run to the Louvre and fetch Ambroise Paré. I don't care about the cost. My beloved Odette must have the best possible care. Go, boy, hurry!" Pierre turned back to the Duke and said, "If you have no further need of me, Your Grace." "Go, Pierre," said Henri. Pierre left the room, and Rollo thought, now what was that pantomime about? Ned Willard had come to Paris to meet Hieronima Ruiz, but he had to be very careful. If she was suspected of passing secret information to Ned, she would be executed, and so might he. He stood in a bookshop in the shadow of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. The shop had once been owned by Sylvie's father. Ned had not known Sylvie at the time, but she had pointed out the place to him in 1572, when they were courting. Now the shop was owned by someone else, and Ned was using it as a convenient place to loiter. He studied the titles on the spines of the books and, at the same time, kept an anxious eye on the great west front of the church with its twin towers. As soon as the tall church doors opened, he abandoned his pretense of shopping and hurried outside. The first person to emerge from the cathedral was Henri III, who had become King of France when his brother, Charles IX, died 9 years ago. Ned watched him smile and wave to the crowd of Parisians in the square. The king was 31. He had dark eyes and dark hair, already receding at the temples to give him a widow's peak. He was what the English called a politician, in French, un politique, meaning that he made decisions about religion according to what he thought would be good for his country, rather than the other way around. He was closely followed by his mother, Queen Caterina, now a dumpy old lady of 64 wearing a widow's cap. The Queen Mother had borne 5 sons, but all had suffered poor health, and so far, 3 had died young. Even worse, none of them had ever fathered a son, which was why the brothers had succeeded one another as kings of France. However, this bad luck had made Caterina the most powerful woman in Europe. Like Queen Elizabeth, she had used her power to arbitrate religious conflict by compromise rather than violence. Like Elizabeth, she had had limited success. As the royal party disappeared across the bridge to the right bank, there was a general exodus from the 3 arched doorways of the cathedral, and Ned joined the crowd, hoping he was inconspicuous among the many people who had come to look at the king. He spotted Hieronima Ruiz in seconds. It was not hard to pick her out from the mob. She wore red, as usual. She was now in her early 40s. The hourglass figure of her youth had thickened, her hair was not so lush, and her lips were no longer full. However, she walked with a sway and looked out alluringly from under black eyelashes. She still radiated sex more powerfully than any other woman in sight, although Ned sensed that what had once been carelessly natural was now achieved with conscious effort. Her eyes met his. There was a flash of recognition, then she looked away. He could not approach her openly. Their meeting had to look accidental. It also had to be brief. He contrived to get close to her. She was with Cardinal Romero, though for the sake of appearances she was not on his arm, but walking a little way behind him. When the Cardinal stopped to speak to Viscount Villeneuve, Ned casually came alongside her. Continuing to smile at no one in particular, Hieronima said, "I'm risking my life. We can talk for only a few seconds." "All right." Ned looked around as if in idle curiosity, while keeping a sharp eye out for anyone who might notice the two of them. Hieronima said, "The Duke of Guise is planning to invade England."
"God's body," said Ned.
"How?"
"Be quiet and listen," she snapped. "Otherwise I won't have time to tell you everything. Sorry. There will be 2 incursions, one on the east coast and one on the south." Ned had to ask, "How many men?"
"I don't know. Please go on."
"There's not much more. Both armies will muster local support and march on London."
"This information is priceless." Ned thanked God that Hieronima hated the Catholic Church for torturing her father. It struck him that her motivation was similar to his own. He had hated authoritarian religion ever since his family had been ruined by Bishop Julius and his cronies. Any time his determination weakened, he thought of how they had stolen everything his mother had worked for all her life, and how a strong and clever woman had seemed to fade away until her merciful death. The pain of the memory flared like an old wound and reinforced Ned's will. He glanced sideways at Hieronyma. Close up, he could see the lines on her face, and he sensed a hard cynicism below her sensual surface. She had become Romero's mistress when she was 18. She had done well to maintain his affection into her 40s, but it had to be a strain.
Thank you for telling me, he said.
His gratitude was heartfelt, but there was something else he needed to know. The Duke of Guise must have English collaborators.
I'm sure.
Do you know who they are?
No.
Remember, my source of information is pillow talk. I don't get to ask probing questions.
If I did, I would fall under suspicion.
I understand, of course.
What's news of Barney?
She said, and Ned detected a wistful note. He spends his life at sea. He has never married, but he has a son, 19 years old.
19?
She said wonderingly.
Where do the years go?
His name is Alfo. He shows some signs of having his father's aptitude for making money.
A clever boy, then. Like all the Willards.
He is clever, yes.
Give Barney my love, Ned.
One more thing.
Make it quick. Romero is coming.
Ned needed a permanent channel through which to communicate with Hieronyma. He improvised hastily. When you get back to Madrid, a man will come to your house to sell you a cream to keep your face young. He was fairly sure he could arrange that through English merchants in Spain. She smiled ruefully.
I use plenty of that kind of thing.
Any information you give him will reach me in London.
I understand.
She turned away from Ned and beamed at the cardinal, sticking out her chest as she did so. They walked away together, Hieronyma wiggling her ample behind. Ned thought they looked sad, a no longer young prostitute, making the most of her tired charms, to retain the affection of a corrupt, pot-bellied old priest. Sometimes Ned felt he lived in a rotten world. The illness of Odette excited Pierre even more than the invasion of England. Odette was the only obstacle on his path to greatness. He was the Duke's principal adviser, listened to more carefully and trusted farther than ever before. He lived in a suite of rooms in the palace in the Vieille Rue du Temple with Odette, Alain, and their longtime maid, Nat. He had been given the lordship of a small village in Champagne, which permitted him to call himself Sieur de Ménil, a member of the gentry, though not of the nobility. Perhaps Duke Henri would never make him a count, but the French aristocracy had won the right to appoint men to high clerical office without approval from Rome, and he could have asked Duke Henri to make him abbot of a monastery, or even a bishop, if only he had not been married. But perhaps now Odette would die. That thought filled him with a hope that was almost painful. He would be free, free to rise up in the councils of the mighty, with almost no limit to how high he might go. Odette's symptoms were pain after eating, diarrhea, bloody stool, and tiredness. She had always been heavy, but her fat had melted away, probably because the pain discouraged her from eating. Dr. Paré had diagnosed stomach fever complicated by dry heat and said she should drink plenty of weak beer and watered wine. Pierre's only dread was that she might recover. Unfortunately, Alain took good care of her. He had abandoned his studies and rarely left her bedside. Pierre despised the boy, but he was surprisingly well-liked by the staff of the palace, who felt sorry for him because his mother was ill. He had arranged to have meals sent to their suite, and he slept on the floor of her room. When he could, Pierre fed Odette all the things Paré said she should avoid, brandy and strong wine, spices and salty food. This often gave her muscle cramps and headaches, and her breath became foul. If he could have had the exclusive care of Odette, he might have killed her this way, but Alain was never absent long enough. When she began to get better, Pierre saw the prospect of a bishopric receding from his destiny, and he felt desperate. The next time Dr. Paré called, he said Odette was on the mend, and Pierre's heart sank further. The sweet prospect of freedom from this vulgar woman began to fade, and he felt disappointment like a wound.
She should drink a strengthening potion now, the doctor said.
He asked for pen, paper, and ink, which Alain quickly supplied.
The Italian apothecary across the street, Giglio, can make this up for you in a few minutes.
It's just honey, licorice, rosemary, and pepper. He wrote on the piece of paper and handed it to Alain. A wild thought came into Pierre's head. Without working out the details, he decided to get rid of Alain. He gave the boy a coin and said, "Go and get it now." Alain was reluctant. He looked at Odette, who had fallen asleep on her feather pillow.
"I don't like to leave her."
Could he possibly have divined the mad idea that had inspired Pierre? Surely not.
"Send Nat,"
Alain said. Nat went to the fish market. "You go to the apothecary. I'll keep an eye on Odette. I won't leave her alone, don't worry." Still, Alain hesitated. He was scared of Pierre. Most people were scared of Pierre, but he could be stubborn at times. Paré said, "Go along, lad. The sooner she drinks that potion, the sooner she will recover." Alain could hardly defy the doctor, and he left the room. Pierre said dismissively, "Thank you for your diligence, doctor. It's much appreciated. I'm always glad to help a member of the Guise family, of course. I'll be sure to tell Duke Henri. How is the Duke?" Pierre was desperate to get Paré out of the room before Alain returned.
"Very well,"
he answered. Odette made a faint noise in her sleep, and Pierre said, "I think she wants the pisspot."
"I'll leave you then," said Paré,
and he went out. This was Pierre's chance. His heart was in his mouth. He could solve all his problems now in a few minutes. He could kill Odette. Two things had kept him from doing it before she fell ill. One was her physical strength. He had not been sure he could overpower her. The other was the fear of Cardinal Charles' wrath. Charles had warned that if Odette died, he would destroy Pierre, regardless of the circumstances. But now Odette was weak and Charles was dead. Would Pierre be suspected anyway? He took pains to play the role of devoted husband. Charles had not been fooled, nor had Alain, but others had, including Henri, who knew nothing of the history. Alain might accuse Pierre, but Pierre would be able to portray Alain as a bereaved son, hysterically blaming his stepfather for a quite natural death. Henri would believe that story. Pierre closed the door. He looked at the sleeping Odette with loathing. Being bullied into marrying her had been his ultimate humiliation. He found himself shaking with a passionate desire. This would be his ultimate revenge. He dragged a heavy chair across the room and pushed it up against the door so that no one could come in. The noise woke Odette. She raised her head and said anxiously, "What's happening?" Pierre tried to make his voice soothing as he replied, "Alain is getting you a strengthening potion from the apothecary." He crossed the room to the bed. Odette sensed danger. In a frightened voice, she said, "Why have you barred the door?"
"So that you're not disturbed," Pierre said.
And with that, he snatched the feather pillow from under her head and put it over her face. He was just quick enough to stifle the scream that started from her throat. She struggled with surprising energy. She managed to get her head out from under the pillow and draw a panicked breath before he was able to push it over her nose and mouth again. She wriggled so much that he had to get onto the bed and kneel on her chest. Even then she was able to use her arms, and she rained punches on his ribs and belly so that he had to grit his teeth to bear the pain and keep pressing the pillow. He felt she might prevail, and he might fail to put an end to her. And that, panicky thought, gave him extra strength, and he pushed down with all his might. At last, she weakened. Her punches became feeble. Then her arms dropped helplessly to her sides. Her legs kicked a few more times, then went still. Pierre kept pressing on the pillow. He did not want to take the risk that she could revive. He hoped Alain would not return yet. Surely it must take Giglio more time than this to make up the mixture. Pierre had never killed anyone. He had been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of heretics and many innocent bystanders, and he still had bad dreams about the piles of naked bodies on the streets of Paris during the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. Even now, he was planning a war with England that would kill thousands. But no one had died by his own hand until now. This was different. Odette's soul was leaving her body while he stopped her breathing. It was a terrible thing. When she had been still for a couple of minutes, he cautiously lifted the pillow
and looked at her face, gaunt from her illness. She was not breathing. He put his hand on her chest and felt no heartbeat. She was gone. He was possessed by exultation. Gone. He replaced the pillow under her head. She looked peaceful in death. There was no sign on her face of the violence of her end. His thrill of triumph passed its peak, and he began to think about the danger of discovery. He moved the chair from the door. He was not sure exactly where it had stood before. Surely no one would notice. Looking around for anything that might cause suspicion, he saw that the bedclothes were unusually rumpled, so he straightened them over Odette's body. Then he did not know what to do. He wanted to leave the room, but he had promised Alain that he would stay, and he would look guilty if he fled. Better to feign innocence. But he could hardly bear to be in the room with the corpse. He had hated Odette, and he was glad she was dead, but he had committed a terrible sin. He realized that God would know what he had done, even if no one else did. He had murdered his wife. How would he obtain forgiveness for such a sin? Her eyes were still open. He was afraid to look at them for fear they would look back. He would have liked to close them, but he dreaded to touch the corpse. He tried to pull himself together. Father Moineau had always assured him of forgiveness, for he was doing God's work. Did not the same apply here? No. Of course not. This had been an act of utter selfishness. He had no excuse. He felt doomed. His hands were shaking, he saw, the hands that had held the pillow over Odette's face so firmly that she had suffocated. He sat on a bench by the window and stared out, so that he did not have to look at Odette. But then he had to turn around every few seconds to assure himself that she was lying still, for he could not help imagining her corpse sitting up in bed, turning its sightless face toward him, pointing an accusing finger, and silently mouthing the words, "He murdered me." At last the door opened and Alain came in. Pierre suffered a moment of pure panic, and almost shouted, "It was me. I killed her." Then his usual calm returned. "Hush," he said, though Alain had made little noise. "She's sleeping." "No, she's not," said Alain. "Her eyes are open." He frowned. "You straightened the bedclothes?" "They were a bit rumpled." Alain's voice showed faint surprise. "That was nice of you." Then he frowned again. "Why did you move the chair?" Pierre was dismayed that Alain had noticed these trivial details. He could not think of an innocent reason for moving the chair, so he resorted to denial. "It's where it always was." Alain looked puzzled, but did not persist. He put a bottle on the little side table and gave Pierre a handful of coins in change. He spoke to the dead body. "I got your medicine, mother," he said. "You can have some right away. It has to be mixed with water or wine." Pierre wanted to scream at him. "Look at her! She's dead!" There was a jug of wine and a cup on the side table. Alain poured some of the potion into the cup, added wine from the jug, and stirred the mixture with a knife. Then, at last, he approached the bed. "Let's get you sitting up," he said. Then he looked hard at her and frowned. "Mother?" His voice fell to a whisper. "Blessed Mary." "No." He dropped the cup to the floor, and the potion spilled oleaginously across the tiles. Pierre watched him with horrid fascination. After a frozen moment of shock, Alain bounded forward and bent over the still form. "Mother!" he shouted, as if a louder voice could bring her back. Pierre said, "Is something wrong?" Alain grabbed Odette by the shoulders and lifted her. Her head flopped back, lifelessly. Pierre moved to the bed, judiciously standing on the side opposite Alain, out of striking range. He was not afraid of Alain physically. It was the other way around. But it would be better to avoid a brawl. "What's the matter?" he said. Alain stared at him in hatred. "What have you done?" "Nothing but watch over her," Pierre said. "But she seems to be unconscious." Alain laid her gently back on the bed, with her head on the pillow that had killed her. He touched her chest, feeling for a heartbeat, then her neck for a pulse. Finally, he put his cheek next to her nose to see if there was any breath. He stifled a sob.
"She's dead."
"Are you sure?" Pierre touched her chest himself, then nodded sadly.
"Ah, terrible," he said, "and we thought she was recovering."
"She was. You killed her, you devil."
"You're very upset, Alain."
"I don't know what you did, but you killed her."
Pierre stepped to the door and shouted for a servant. "In here, anybody, quickly!"
Alain said, "I'm going to kill you."
The threat was laughable.
"Don't say things you don't mean."
"I will,"
Alain repeated.
"You've gone too far this time. You've murdered my mother, and I'm going to get you back. If it takes me as long as I live, I will kill you with my own hands and watch you die."
For a brief moment, Pierre felt a chill of fear. Then he shook it off. Alain was not going to kill anyone. He looked along the corridor and saw Nat approaching, carrying a basket, evidently back from the market.
"Come here, Nat," he said, "quickly. A very sad thing has happened."
Sylvie put on a black hat with a heavy veil and went to the funeral of Odette Aumont de Guise.